This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach!
Give me great food.
Tacos!
Give me adventure.
Hiking!
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise!
Give me some smiles.
Cheese!
Give me more beaches.
Beaches!
What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Savor, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we have an episode for you about baklava.
Yes. Was there any particular reason this was on your mind, Lauren?
Oh, I don't think so. I think I was looking for a baked good and maybe it had been on our list, or maybe I'd been thinking about it from the last time that I ordered, like, Greek tavern takeout. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, I have very fond memories of baklava.
Oh, me too. I love it.
I have a friend who, that is her go-to dessert. And she's a friend that I adore, so I have positive associations with her and baklava because of it. But that's kind of the only time I have it.
Oh, really?
She brings it. Or, you know, if I do go to like a Greek restaurant or somewhere that has it, I might get it. But she definitely is the person that brings it. So I think of her when I think of it.
Yeah.
And I love when you have those friends where you're like,
oh, yeah.
Yes.
Looking forward to that one. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I've made it a couple of times. I certainly haven't rolled out my own phyllo dough, that 0%. But yeah, I find the process really meditative. You know, it just sort of, it's a little bit fussy and a little bit repetitive, but kind of in a nice way. You know, you're just going at your own pace. You're just doing your thing. And at the end, you get baklava.
That sounds nice.
Yeah.
That sounds nice. I think that's a better way to look at it than I often do, which is why this not done yet.
Oh, but see, you're much better at creating like show-stopping pieces. Like, I'm not the guy who's going to decorate something, but if making it happens to require putting down 20 layers of incredibly thin pastry, I'm like, yeah, that's fine.
This is why we work together well. Yeah.
Different kinds of detail orientation.
Yes, indeed. Well, I guess this brings us to our question.
I guess it does.
Baklava. What is it?
Well, baklava is a type of dessert baked good made of many layers of extremely thin wheat flour dough, brushed with butter or ghee, and sandwiched with some kind of filling, often fine chopped nuts, and then baked to an airy crisp, and then, usually, drenched in sweet syrup. The result is a delicate with this crisp crunch that gives way to a light, nutty chew that gives way to just a sort of melting sweetness. It is pretty rich, so it's often served in small pieces. The filling can include warm spices or fruit or dairy like a custard, and the syrup can be made from white sugar or honey, or can be flavored with a lemon or florals like rose water. The pastry can be served warm or room temperature. It can be absolutely doused in syrup or have a little bit of a lighter hand in there. It's a really ephemeral thing. It's like if you could eat a book of poetry, just sweet and satisfying, but also fleeting.
Yeah. Oh, baklava. Oh, baklava.
All right, so let's break down those ingredients. The sheets of dough are a type called phyllo or yufka, made often with just flour and water, sometimes with egg or dairy in there. And from what I understand, again, no personal experience here, it takes a lot of patience and practice and a light hand to roll them out properly. They should be paper thin, like tissue paper thin, like translucent. Like, you should be able to read print through a sheet of phyllo dough. If you have never seen artisans making it in bakeries, I highly recommend looking that up. It's a beautiful process. Okay. To construct a baklava, you layer sheets of this dough in a baking dish, brushing each one with melted butter, or maybe clarified butter, or browned butter, or melted ghee, the latter two of which will add kind of toasty flavors from the fact that you've cooked that butter down a bit and caramelized some of the sugars in it. And then, depending on the type that you're making, once every few sheets, or sometimes in a thick layer in the middle, you're going to spread in whatever filling you're using. That filling, often fine chopped nuts like pistachios, walnuts, almonds, or pecans, maybe some combination, with just a little bit of sugar mixed in there, sometimes with spices like cinnamon, cloves, or cardamom, or with vanilla. Alternatively, some kind of dairy, like a custard or clotted cream, or like a fresh unsalted farmer's cheese type cheese. Sometimes both nuts and a dairy. I can't tell you what to do. And then you slice it, yes, pre-baking, into whatever shapes you like. Small triangles or diamonds are easy, common shapes to make in a rectangular pan. Yeah, do what you want. And then you bake it low and slow. That buttery thin dough is going to puff up around the filling and be crimped down where you made the cuts and will go golden brown. Or sometimes you're using such a thin layer on top that it just like the green of the pistachio or whatever filling is going to show through. Super cool. I did see in a couple places that in Turkish tradition, there's a saying or concept that the layers should be so light and thin that you should be able to drop a coin straight through to the bottom. But I'm not sure at what point you're supposed to do the coin drop. Anyway, this is a thing that I've heard. At any rate, you bake it, and then while it's still warm, you give it that sugar soak. You might melt down white sugar with water to make a sort of thin syrup, or thin out honey or even molasses. You might season it with lemon juice, rose water, orange blossom water, and then you just pour it all over the pan, usually enough to saturate the bottom few layers of pastry. It can be served straight away or allowed to cool to room temperature, or reheat later if you like. It's often eaten as a dessert or snack, sometimes with a strong coffee or tea. And you can find it in bakeries, especially ones from the East Mediterranean to like Central Asia regions, or you can make it at home. And yes, you can, as I have, buy pre-made frozen phyllo dough in many grocery stores to use if you do not want to learn the artisan construction of this dough. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are all kinds of local variations based on either what has historically been available and preferred, perhaps a filling of walnuts and cinnamon with honey and lemon syrup in parts of Greece, or walnuts with cinnamon and cloves in parts of Armenia, or almonds with cinnamon, rose water, and geranium syrup in Cyprus, or orange blossom syrup in Algeria, or rose water and cardamom in Iran. Some varieties will indeed appear green instead of golden brown due to pistachio content. And, of course, this is not even scratching the surface. Like, people get up to all kinds of things. You know, you can use hazelnuts or peanuts or pine nuts, a paste of ground nuts instead of chopped nuts. You can add chopped chocolate or cocoa powder or coffee grounds. You can use fillings like sour cherry or poppy seed. You can cut the pastry into any dang shape you like, or roll or fold the layers of dough into different shapes before cutting and baking, or make nests of shredded phyllo. You can flavor the syrup with citrus zest or pomegranate juice, or thin it out with milk. There are versions that don't really use syrup at all.
whole world out there.
a world of baklava.
A world of baklava. Well, speaking of, what about the nutrition?
This is a calorie-dense food. Sugar is a treat. Treats are nice.
They are nice.
So nice. Mm-hmm. Nuts are good for you. I don't know.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we do have some numbers for you.
We do. Okay. World record. I think this is the first time in a minute we've had a world record. Okay. The Guinness World Record for the largest baklava goes to a pastry weighing 1,130 pounds. That's 513 kilos that was created in Ankara, Turkey in 2018. It contained round about 11,800 pieces of baklava. And 14 pastry chefs from around the country got together to make it.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. One popular chain of bakeries out of Turkey called, I really hope I'm not butchering this, Gololu Baklava, has 48 locations around the world. In Istanbul alone, the chain produces some 6,600 pounds of baklava every day. That's like 3,000 kilos. That's one. That's one chain.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Another city in Turkey is particularly famous for baklava, Gaziantep, also called Antep. As of a decade ago, it had some 100 baklava bakeries supplying some 90% of the baklava in Turkey. An earlier Frommer's travel guide from 2001 said that the city had some 500 baklava bakeries at the time.
Wow. That's a lot of baklava.
It is.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. And there has been quite a lot of history around this pastry.
Oh, yes, yes. And we are going to get into that history as soon as we get back from a quick break for a word from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow, thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so we've done a lot of episodes about things that are related to baklava, somewhat tangentially, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Baked goods of various kinds.
Yes, indeed. But the practice of sweetening wheat of some type and mixing it with things like fruits and nuts is a very long one. Mm-hmm. Though the history of baklava itself is much contested and fought over, particularly between Turkey and Greece, although they are by no means the only places fighting over baklava. Mm-hmm. Armenia is also a big proponent and they're mm-hmm. a big contester. Most historians believe that the early history of baklava goes back to 8th century BCE to the Assyrian Empire, which is now parts of Iraq, Iran, Kuwait, Syria, and Turkey, when folks would layer unleavened flatbread with chopped nuts and serve it as special occasions. The ancient Romans and Greeks made placenta cake, placenta here meaning, I didn't go into the etymology of it, but cheese, meaning cheese.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
Yes, placenta cake centuries later, which consisted of cheese and honey, maybe using bay leaves for flavor, layered between dough, baked and drizzled with more honey. When it comes to our more modern understanding of baklava, though, that most likely goes back to the time of the Ottoman Empire, about 500 years ago. Since the 11th century CE, layered, folded, dough-based pastries, both sweet and savory, have been a part of Central Asian Turkish cuisine. Also, this timeline is kind of messy, so please bear with me. Baklava evolved from that, perhaps alongside the Arab practice of soaking dough in honey or in a sugar syrup. The earliest known reference to baklava is in a Turkish poem written during the first half of the 15th century, which implies that it was fairly well known in the region by that time.
Yeah, the poem, by the way, was about banquets, and it references a filling of what could be interpreted as either almonds or lentils. No one is entirely sure. But so a banquet food is what this poem was setting this item out to be.
Yes, yes. And then kind of separately, some historians claim that by the 10th century CE, what was essentially baklava was a delicacy in Greece, and that through trade routes, it made its way to places like Armenia. So some think that Greece made an early version that spread along trade routes that was then perfected in Turkey and then traveled back to Greece where it was adapted. Again, these are a lot of this is like arguments over definitions.
Yeah. And also just the mysteries of history, you know? Yeah.
Exactly. And we will talk about that more later because this is still going on today. But, okay, because the pastry was tricky to make and the frequently used ingredients, which were honey, sugar, and nuts, were expensive, it was typically reserved for special occasions, including things like weddings and Ramadan. A 1474 palace kitchen register showed that baklava with 41 layers were being made daily for Ramadan. Many Ottoman recipes later called for 60 layers for their baklava. It was often cooked over low heat coal embers. And when the palace staff couldn't keep up with demand for this complicated pastry, they outsourced this work to women in the region. And it was a lot, like, it was a lot of baklava that was being made.
Yeah. And I really cannot overemphasize how much work getting that dough that thin without murdering it is. It's difficult.
Yes. Yes. I found a whole article that was just like the process of it. Mm-hmm. And I got overwhelmed just reading it. Like, oh, wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So as early as 1520 CE, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire would give his elite soldiers large amounts of baklava during Ramadan. And this was known as the baklava procession. And this practice remained in place until 1826, and it was a lot of baklava. Again, I stress, it was a lot of it. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, some Ottoman Christians made baklava for Lent, even going as far as to have 40 layers of phyllo dough to represent the 40 days of Lent. Others went for 33 layers to symbolize the 33 years of Christ's life. Some Jewish people living in the Ottoman Empire served baklava during Rosh Hashanah and Purim. Of note, though, baklava was often a part of charitable practices as early as the late 15th century. So it was something that marked special occasions a lot of the time, but that wasn't the only time people made and ate it.
Yeah. During the Ottoman Empire, there was a particularly developed practice of public kitchens that anyone could come eat at free of charge, often part of like a larger complex along with a mosque or inn or school or kind of all of the above. And baklava was big in these kitchens. And around the same time, middle-class folks were making it too. There are records of copper baking trays being passed down through families. And special events, though, did have reportedly, like, wildly impressive iterations. This one Turkish travel writer wrote that that wedding feasts in Belgrade featured baklavas the size of wagon wheels with 1,000 layers of dough. Yeah. Which is probably an exaggeration, but by how much? Nobody knows.
Mysteries history, mm-hmm. once again.
Mm-hmm.
At the height of the Ottoman Empire, baklava spread along trade routes, especially to the Mediterranean and the Middle East, where baklava was adapted to local ingredients and taste. So in some places, pistachios were more common, like Turkey, and walnuts were more available in others, like Greece. The syrup flavorings varied, too, from rose water and cardamom to orange blossom water. So we get these different varieties that some people are very strongly opinionated about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. In the 19th century, records indicate that the process of rolling out the phyllo dough had been simplified, allowing to roll out 10 or more pieces of dough at once.
Streamlined, yeah. By dusting layers, each layer of dough with cornstarch or wheat starch to prevent sticking, bakers could roll out a bunch of layers at once instead of having to work on a single sheet at a time. And these starches are industrially made products that hit the scene in the mid-1800s. So, yeah.
Right.
During World War II, flour shortages in Turkey led to a temporary ban on making baklava.
And then, jumping ahead, when President Obama enjoyed some baklava at a celebratory dinner for Greek Independence Day in 2012, which is independence from the Ottoman Empire, by the way, there were rumors in the Turkish press that this signaled he'd picked a side in the debate between Turkey and Greece over baklava's origins. The following year, the European Union granted southern Turkey's Gaziantep variety with protected status.
Turkey had been working on getting EU protected geographical indication status for the product since 2007. The specific variety from Antep has this filling of local pistachio and a type of a custard or cream that's thickened with semolina flour, and it's doused in sugar syrup, not honey. And this means that iterations made in other places or in other ways cannot use the name Antep baklava in the EU. The official seal has this background that looks a little bit like a circular pan of rectangle sliced baklava. Super cute.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say, like, there were plenty of heated arguments, plenty of them. I won't say they're not legitimate at all.
Oh, yeah.
But I will also say a lot of the things I read were very optimistic. And this is from places like Greece or Turkey or even Armenia, where they were like, you know, seems like this is something that connects us. This is something we all like, as opposed to something that divides us.
Yeah.
It shows that we have similar but also specific taste. Like, this version is our version. That's your version. But they also have similarities, that different varieties emerge in different specific places. So I'm not saying that there isn't a heated debate and debate about it, but there was a lot from what I read of people being like, it makes sense that we all came up with this and it kind of along their own paths.
Yeah.
That came their own specific things.
Yeah. That, you know, we all, due to this shared cultural history in a lot of ways, had access to these same products or similar products and similar methods. And through that cultural trade, yeah. One last note in the timeline. In 2023, after the devastating earthquake that hit Turkey and Syria, one of the restaurants and bakeries in Antep that happened to still be standing made itself into a modern charity kitchen and shelter. They did resume making baklava after just 9 days because people were asking for it, sort of as a comforting symbol of the hope of returning to normalcy.
Yeah. Again, that's the power of that food, you know?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yeah. As we were going through our little opening spiel, I was like feeling weird about the fact that both of our references were to Greek restaurants. I think that in the Atlanta area specifically, especially like in the past, up until the very recent past, we've had like a bunch of Greek restaurants, very few Turkish or otherwise Eastern Mediterranean, Central Asian restaurants. I think we've got a few now. I think we're growing. I haven't been to them yet because there's been a whole pandemic, but yeah.
Yeah. I know a couple. Because my friend actually comes more from not the Greek part. I associate baklava with. Yeah, but it is true. Most of the time, I have associated it with Greece here. But it's great. I love that. Based on what I read, at least, there does seem to be a lot of like, oh, that's what you're doing? Well, we're doing this.
We're doing this, and it's better, but that's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Which I appreciate.
Oh, yeah.
Which I appreciate.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that's what we have to say about baklava for now.
Yes. We would love to hear anything that y'all have to say about it, though. And we do already have some listener mail ready for you. But first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Pronamel.
Not all our favorite foods and drinks are BFFs with our teeth. Salad dressings, seltzers, and fruits can be enamel enemies. So if you eat or drink those things regularly, your enamel could be at risk. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Pronamel Intensive Enamel Repair penetrates deep into the enamel surface, locking in vital minerals to repair acid-weakened enamel. And with new Pronamel Repair mouthwash, you can enhance that repair beyond just brushing.
Pronamel is the number one dentist-recommended brand for acid erosion, so buy Pronamel Repair anywhere you buy toothpaste or mouthwash. Visit pronamel.com.
I'm Elia Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Wow. Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with Listener Mail Layers.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So we have a really fun listener mail today. It's a bit longer, so we're just going to split this one up. Mm-hmm. From a frequent writer, but we haven't heard from them in a while, Big Yogi. And this is a great story. So
yeah,
let's get into it. Mm-hmm. Big Yogi wrote, just listened to your sea urchin episode, and it brought back some good memories from the days when I used to do a lot of scuba diving and underwater hunting. I used to collect urchin a lot when it was in season, and I often used urchin to catch other fish. Fish go bonkers for sea urchin. Underwater, I would open up a couple of urchin, wave the halves of one of the urchin to create a bit of a cloud with insides of the urchin. And the next thing you know, you are surrounded by what seems like every fish within 50 yards trying to get at the urchin. It's insane how crazy the fish go when you hold up the other urchin. At that point, we could select what fish we wanted and get it with a sling spear. In one area I used to dive and hunt at, a local female sea lion we called Big Mama made a practice of collecting taxes from the divers while they were hunting. If she saw a diver in the area that had a game bag, she would harass that diver until the diver surrendered part of the day's catch to her. If a diver refused to give Big Mama her tax, she would take the diver's entire game bag, often dragging the helpless diver along with the bag until the bag came loose. Big Mama's favorite foods were lobster and sea urchin. She would sometimes hit divers with her nose and then swim a few feet away before turning and looking at the diver until the diver got the message she wanted the diver to follow her. Big Mama would then guide the diver to a hole where lobsters were hiding, or to where a bunch of urchins were.
Wow.
Big Mama would then wait until the diver pulled lobster out of the hole or until the diver opened up some urchins for her. Big Mama would expect every diver she saw to feed her a bit as her tax and would make her rounds to each diver until each diver gave something up to her. Big Mama would also often have a pup or two with her and appeared to be teaching the pups the same tax collecting method. Woe be the diver that did not pay the tax, because then Big Mama acted like she was the bookie that you were late paying off. Divers who absolutely refused to give Big Mama her cut often ended up getting quite the underwater beatdown. Many a stubborn diver ended up back at the beach covered in cuts and deep bruises, and some ended up with broken ribs or broken appendages. Then after the beating, Big Mama would make off with the diver's entire catch anyway, so you were better off if you just gave up what she was asking for. Pay your taxes, folks. Oh dear.
Oh my goodness. If y'all are not familiar with sea lions, I need to impress upon you that like a lady sea lion at like relative minimum is gonna weigh about like 200 pounds. That's like 100 kilos. Like, they are bigger than you think, and if they want your lobster tax, then you should just give it to them. If they have also made it clear, then do that. Be like, yes, ma'am, and give it to them.
Big Mama has some good taste, is what we can say for sure.
Oh, my goodness, right?
Lobster and sea urchin.
Love this. Okay, all right. They continue. My last urchin comes with a recipe. It is how we got Billy's stuck butt bisque. One time I went on a chartered dive trip with a bunch of friends to Catalina Island. One of our group was a friend of a friend situation and was one of the most obnoxious humans I have ever personally dealt with. And his name was Billy. Billy was extremely egotistical and had to brag about how much better he was at everything than anyone else. People fantasized about stranding Billy on one of the uninhabited Channel Islands within an hour of first meeting him. One of my friends, who was one of the most peaceful, granola hippie girls you would ever meet, stated out loud that she wanted to cut Billy's airlines while at depth after Billy made a very crass pickup attempt on her. Well, on the very first dive, Billy descended butt first on a bed of urchin. He had at least 10 urchins embedded in his booty and the back of his thighs, causing Billy to ascend to the surface far too rapidly, causing decompression sickness, and he had to be airlifted to the mainland for treatment. Karma can be crazy. Before the helicopter came to get Billy, we had used pliers to extract the urchin, and later that night in the galley, I turned those very same urchin into a bisque, which the other divers named Billy's Stuck Butt Bisque, in celebration of Billy's departure from the group. The recipe follows. It sounds like a really nice bisque. I'd say that the really fun parts, yeah, are the addition of some sea urchins, some whole sea urchins, and the serving of the soup in those sea urchins' shells.
I have to say, this is an amazing twist of a story in so many ways, because I believe the email, the subject line was Billy's Stuck Butt Bisque. And I just assumed that it had to do with like pork butt.
Sure.
That's where your
food brain goes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And then I was reading this, I was like, whoa, this did not go like I thought it was gonna go. I got some jerk who's got a lot of urchins in his butt. And then you made a delicious recipe out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, might as well.
Might as well. Yeah. You know, turn those, find the rainbows in those rain clouds.
Find the bisque in those butt sea urchins.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I hope that Billy, I don't want to say learned a lesson, but maybe learned a lesson. I don't know. Because
that's a lot of comeuppance.
That's an experience to be helicoptered out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I hope.
As I learned from Michael Crichton's novel Sphere, decompression sickness is nothing to contend with.
No, we don't mess with that at all. Goodness.
But also, just in general, like, be nice. If you're scuba diving, be nice to your compatriots, man. Like, that's not an environment in which you want to make anyone mad.
Yeah, you don't want to have people annoyed at you when your life is somewhat in their hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Maybe we don't go down butt first, but...
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I don't really know, so what can I say?
Sure. But
it didn't work out for you. but it did result in a delicious-sounding recipe. Thank you so much for writing in, for sharing this recipe. If anybody wants it, just let us know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can forward it along.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, if you would like to contact us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
And we're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @SaverPod. And we do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.
Hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy. Yeah. Right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.